So we've been going through this text, The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. In the first section, it talks a lot about karma. And this second section that we're talking on now talks principally about the faults of our self-centered attitude and the faults of our self-grasping ignorance. And in doing so, it points out all of our faults. Okay? These are our own faults, but these faults are due to our own misconception mind. So we shouldn't think that we are inherently union oneness with them. Okay? But in talking about these things that we get involved in, Dharma Rakshita, the author of this text, is trying to get us to look at our behavior and then look at its causes, principally the ignorance and the self-centeredness, so that we can apply the antidotes to them, so that we can actually wind up with a state of lasting happiness instead of just spinning our wheels looking for happiness where there isn't any. Okay? So he's pretty pointed in what he points out to us. He doesn't pull any punches here. Okay, so I think we are on verse 67. Yeah. So it says, I harbor all my self-centered desires deep within and blame others for all my disputes for no reason. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so those last two lines are kind of a refrain that comes with every verse here. But let's go into the first two lines first. I harbor all my self-centered desires deep within. Okay, so we do, don't we? Yeah. And even though we may be Dharma practitioners and have the air and the appearance of Dharma practitioners and talk a lot of nice words about Dharma practice and let others know how many teachings we've had, how many initiations we've had, all the times we've met His Holiness, all the things we've been to, our great retreat experience, blah, blah, blah. Deep inside, what is there? Desire. Anger. You know, just our self-centered desires are so strong and we hold on to it even though we might put out an appearance of being this very nice Dharma practitioner. So we don't admit our afflictions, our negative emotions to other people or even to ourselves. You know, sometimes we are able to deceive ourselves quite well. Oh, I studied the Dharma very well. I've read all these books, you know, or I've been to teaching. So I know it very well. I don't have a lot of attachment. I don't have jealousy, anger, these things. So, you know, we kind of lie to ourselves, rationalize, justify. And then to other people, you know, we do the same. And, you know, certainly if we can't acknowledge our faults to ourselves, we're not going to acknowledge them to other people because we don't know we have them. And even if we do realize we have some difficulty with desire, it's like, well, who wants to fess up to it in front of other people, especially when we're supposed to all be nice, sweet little Buddhists? Yeah. Or even, you know, we're not supposed to be nice, sweet little Buddhists. You know, we want to have a good reputation. We don't want to say, well, actually, you know, every moment of my life I'm just thinking about what benefits me. You know, we don't want to say that. It's the truth, but we don't want to say it. Okay, so we make up all these, you know, nice things and, you know, pretend to be so kind and stuff like that, but actually, everything is still revolving around me and how I can be happy, how I can be secure, how I can get what I want, how I can look good, how I can avoid problems. Okay. So this line is kind of trying to get us to become a little bit more honest with ourselves and then to clean up our own internal mess instead of just following along with it. The second line says, okay, so the first was, I harbor all my self-centered desires deep within and blame others for all my disputes for no reason. Okay? So all of our desires are all in here. How can I get what I want? How can I look good? Then when there's some difficulty, what do? Your fault. You know, why are you doing that? Why don't you go do this? Why don't you do that? You know, how can you treat me like this? How can you treat those other people like that? You should do things like this. You know, and every time there's a problem, what do? Somebody else's fault. You know, and it's amazing because, like, this is the whole essence of the Dharma, you know, that our mind is the creator of our experiences, and our mind creates our desires and our attachments. Our mind creates all of our enemies and then gets angry at them. And we can see that so clearly intellectually. We can lead great meditations on the topic. But what happens when we have a dispute or a conflict with somebody? Me? I didn't do anything wrong. Not my fault. I'm sweet, innocent, kind, generous, cooperative. It's your fault. You know, you did this. You're selfish. You're trying to get it all for yourself. You're conniving. You're manipulative. You know, and we point out everything else around other people's things. We blame them for faults we have. You know, we project our faults onto them and then blame them for having our faults. We scapegoat other people. We get angry at them for no reason and accuse them of doing all sorts of things. You know, and the other person, very often, is like, they have no clue what in the world we're talking about. But we're just, you know, our opinion factory is working overtime and we're making up all these things. We take a little bit of evidence and make up this whole storyline about what somebody else is about. Just like this morning, we saw the trailer and the sacks, and already, you know, it's like these people and who knows what they're doing, and maybe it's a meth lab or maybe it's a this or a that, or they have guns, they might come out and shoot us because we're in the middle of Eastern Washington, and you know, and the mind just, you know, fabricates things. And whenever we have problems similar, you know, we just, our faults, we project onto other people, we accuse them of having them, you know, where there's a dispute, I'm trying so hard to remedy this dispute, but you aren't doing your share, yeah, and so we always see it like that, you know, so we accuse people and criticize them even though they haven't done anything, they haven't provoked us at all, we see provocation and we accuse them. You know, we expect that everything should go our way and all the victory, all the profit should come to us. Yeah, whenever there's something good, I should get it. Whenever there's a problem, you can have it. Yeah. Everything good should come to me. Everybody should help me. Everybody should do what I want. They should all do what I want when I want them to do it. Not at another time. You know, but right now, kind of talk to it. And, you know, and then we blame them when they, you know, don't meet our very far-fetched expectations. And then when there is a conflict, we push and we push and we push and we have to make sure that we have the last word. You know, there's this one verse in the eighth verses of thought training. How does it go? Renee, help me. It's verse 5. When about taking the defeat upon myself and giving the victory to others. How does the first part go? When others abuse, others heap me with abuse and so on, I will accept defeat. Yeah. But it's this great verse in the eight verses of thought training that's completely un-American. Yeah. Because in America, you know, offer the victory to others and accept defeat upon ourselves. Never. You know, we as a country, we've got to have the last word. As individuals, we've got to have the last word. Okay. When others out of jealousy, mistreat me with abuse, slander, and so on. I will practice accepting defeat and offering the victory to them. Okay, so we don't want to do that. Yeah? Others out of jealousy mistreat me, abuse me. I'm not going to offer the victory to them. I'm going to fight, you know, and I'm going to clear my name, and I'm going to make sure everybody sees that I'm right and they're wrong. And, you know, and so, I mean, that's just using an example of jealousy as the motivating factor. It could be anything that we have a conflict in. But then, you know, we just grasp on and we have to have the last word. You know, whenever there's a conflict, we have to have the last word. And even if it's somebody we care dearly about, and even if hammering to have our own way alienates the other person from us, we're still going to do it. Yeah. I had one friend who, she and her partner were having some difficulties, and they went to see a counselor. And, like, right in the middle of the session, you know, the difficult conflict came up, and her partner is, like, pushing. And the counselor said to him, do you want to be right? What's more important to you, to be right or to be close to her? And he stopped dead in his tracks, you know, because that's the way we are. It's like we're so intent on being right that we'll, you know, sacrifice a relationship that's very dear to us simply because we want to push and push until we have the final word. And of course, even if we win the argument, the other person's resentful. They may capitulate just to kind of, it's too much of a hassle fighting, so they capitulate. But then they're not happy inside, and then they're, you know, they're not going to be gracious and loving to us afterwards. Okay, so we're just kind of digging our own trench, in that kind of situation. But where does all this come from? You know, this whole thing of harboring deep desires and then blaming disputes and conflicts on the other person, it all comes from the betrayer, false conception, you know, the fabricating mind, the mind that fabricates an inherently existent self, the mind that conceives that this self is now the most important thing in the world. And so that's why the refrain of these verses says, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. So don't let it away. You know, when we see, I mean, what lies behind having all these, you know, deep, dark, lurking desires and horrendous anger and blaming other people, what lies behind it? Yeah, wrong conception of the self and tremendous amount of self-centeredness, self-absorption. So those two are the chief enemies. So that's what we're dancing on the head of, because those two minds are what betray us. We're trying to be happy. They pretend to be our friends, but they actually create so many problems for us. So it says, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay? So really hit at it. Don't let it have any leeway when we see that our mind is becoming totally self-centered and me, and I've got to win, and I've got to have this, and it's got to be my way, and I've got to clear my name, and everybody's, you know, got to agree that I was the innocent one and the other one was the bad one. You know, when we see that our mind is doing that, just to stop and say, you know, this is my own self-centered thought that's fooling me again and, you know, causing me to have so much inner conflict and difficult and external conflict with other people. You know, because this mind, you know, when we're so deeply holding on to, you know, looking good and winning the fight and, you know, getting other people on our side, you know, because when there's a conflict with somebody else, then we go and talk about, you know, this person is doing this, and we talk with everybody else here so that they're all on our side against that person because, you know, we need some support. So then we all develop the same, you know, misconceptions together and attack and project and attack the same faults on this other person. And, you know, where does it all come from? You know, this mind that's saying, I'm the most important one in the universe, and what happens to me right now is the most crucial thing that exists. You know, there's starving people all over the place. There's war, there's famine, there's all these things going on. But that is inconsequential because my dispute with this other person is much more important. and I'm going to win this dispute. And, you know, I'm going to come out looking good, and I'm going to rub their nose in the mud. Yeah. And, you know, and we go for it. And then it's so crazy because, you know, who cares about this anyway? I mean, at the time we die, do we want to be thinking about this dispute? Is it still going to be important to us? No, is this the way we want it? Is this what's going to give us ultimate pleasure in life, is to die saying, I won that argument? No, I don't think so. You know, in fact, chances are by the time we get to death, we're going to feel even more miserable because, you know, of making others miserable. And furthermore, we've just continued to create so much negative karma. And that negative karma comes with us at the time of death. But the person we fought with, you know, they can die and go on to a next life. Yeah? Or maybe we make up with them, or we separate, or we don't see them again. But, you know, everything changes. And yet, you know, so that conflict is dispersed, but we carry with us the negative karma that, you know, that first of all makes us meet with unpleasantness and misery in future lives, and second of all, that negative karma is part of the veil and the pollution and the obscuration on our mind stream that prevents us from understanding emptiness, realizing the nature of reality. You know, so spiritually it just, you know, tarnishes our mind and impedes what we're trying to do. Okay. Then, next verse, verse 68. Though clad in saffron robes, I seek protection from treacherous ghosts. Though having taken the precepts, my conduct accords with that of a demon. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. So this is talking about monastics, you know, people clad in saffron robes, or even if you're a lay person, if you've taken the five precepts, so you have refuge in the three jewels, you know, that's the first, before you take any precepts or at all, the first thing is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So though we have refuge, what do? I seek protection from treacherous ghosts. You know, so here's the Buddha whose mind is completely free of all faults and endowed with all good qualities. You know, the Buddha who's practiced the path for three countless great eons and, you know, attained the results. So he's somebody we can trust. The Dharma, which is the path to realizations and the realizations themselves and the cessations of suffering. And the Sangha, those who have the Buddha's followers who have understood the nature of reality directly through their own experience, so they're also reliable guides. So we've taken refuge and sought spiritual instruction and guidance from them, but then what do? Is seek protection from treacherous ghosts. So, you know, this is also seeing when it talks about ghosts, it's talking about, you know, there aren't just human and animals, but there's all different kinds of life form. You know, there's various ghosts, there's hellish beings, there's gods and demigods, and all sorts of different beings that we can't see. And so instead of entrusting our spiritual guidance to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, entrusting them to the ghosts, so going to fortune tellers and doing, you know, where an oracle speaks through a medium and tarot cards and, you know, all this kind of stuff. We go to that and we listen to that, even though our refuge is in the three jewels. Okay. So I remember one of my teachers, probably Geshe-Nalandarge, who taught me this text. He used to say that, you know, when we study in the Buddha's teachings, you know, that if we create negative actions, that it brings suffering. And, you know, that we are subject to sickness, aging, and death because we have a body, so therefore we should aspire to purify our karma and get out of cyclic existence. He says when we hear those teachings from a spiritual teacher, we say, yeah, 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 yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. Oh, maybe they're going to say something new, you know. Let's turn the channel. But if we go to a fortune teller, and a fortune teller says, you know, you're going to get sick this year, and you better do some strong purification. Boy, we are ready to go. You know, give me that prostration text. I'm going to do all the prostrations. I'm going to do Vajrasattva. I'm going to purify. You know? And it's so funny because you really see this. I mean, I remember when he said it, you know, I kind of thought, oh, that's funny. But then hanging around, I thought, yes, this is exactly what happened. Yeah? It was so interesting when we went at the beginning of this month to this holistic fair in Spokane. You know, the Abbey had a little booth. And on both sides, there were psychics, you know, who were, you know, doing their thing. And some people, you know, I do have psychic powers either because of meditation or because of karma or whatever, you know. But these people, you know, so many people, they did much better business. You know, we'd have a few people walk by us, but this side and this side, they were always filled. And I was watching, you know, and the people who would come, you know, I mean, they had to pay to get there, you know, to talk to the psychic. And one guy, he was doing psychic things in astrology, so he would be looking up some stuff and then looking at the person explaining and then looking up something else and explaining. But the person he was explaining to was like this. I just watched, and he's just completely fixated on the psychic. One person after the other, I mean, their eyes did not waver one second. You know, they didn't look to the side, they didn't look down, you know, just completely enraptured. And I was thinking, this is very interesting, you know, because when you have a psychic tell you all about you, you know, it's like me, and, you know, I don't pay attention here. And, but when we come to Dharma class, you know, we figure, well, this isn't all about me, you know. Buddha says everybody had 84,000 delusions, but I don't. I only have one or two, so I don't need to listen to these teachings. Oh, look at our watch, and we scratch our head. We are. Get distracted, you know. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. So it's quite interesting. So Dharma Rakshita is really pointing this out to us. Yeah. And saying that this is not really suitable, that when we have a perfect refuge, we should follow the guidance of a perfect refuge. And the Dharma teachings that we get, you know, those are the instructions for us to follow. Some people, when they hear follow the instructions of the spiritual mentor, they think it means only when your teacher says, get me a cup of tea, you know, or do this job or that, you know. And that's not following, I mean, that is following the instructions, but the real instructions are the things that are said to us during teachings. You know, now we may not be able to put everything into practice all at once because the Dharma is so vast, but at least we try and listen, let the seeds get planted in our mind stream, practice according to how we're able, but we make some effort to remember the teachings and put them into practice. And that's following the advice and instructions of our spiritual mentor. But so often we think, well, it's not instructions unless the teacher tells me one-on-one. Yeah. And the big caveat is when I agree with what they tell me to do. When I don't agree, I'm not going to do it. Yeah. But then we profess, you know, extreme devotion and unwavering faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and our spiritual mentor. But then, you know, it doesn't kind of get manifest like that. Okay. So as the verse continues, so having taken precepts, my conduct accords with that of a demon. You know, so though we've taken monastic vows, we've taken the five precepts, our general conduct is completely off the wall, you know. Take a precept not to drink, but, oh, well, you're with a group of people who don't know you have that precept, and they're not Buddhist, and they're kind of big. Then you start rationalizing, oh, they feel so much more relaxed if I drank, too, because they're going to think I'm really prudish and uptight if I don't drink, so I'll just have a drink, and nobody will know the difference. Yeah? And so we make up all these things. Or, you know, we've taken a precept against stealing and against lying, but then, you know, somebody approaches us with some kind of stock market, something scam of, you know, I don't understand all this stuff. But who was this? This famous person who just got busted? Martha Stewart? You know, that kind of thing. Wasn't that like lying and stealing and deceiving? You know, that kind of thing. So we say, oh, you know, I'm this very ethical, you know, wonderful practitioner. you know, taken precepts, but then our behavior is like that of a demon. Another, and here demon means the self-centered thought. So, you know, getting involved in all these kind of, you know, shady business deals or things that, you know, aren't so kosher, and we've, you know, whitewash them and, you know, make it all look good. Why do we get involved with those things? Because there's a chance for us to profit. You know, who cares if it's legal or not legal? There's a chance for me to profit. You know, and probably, you know, even if it's illegal, I can just say, well, I didn't know. Yeah, and so we get ourselves in a whole bunch of trouble, and you can see it all comes from the self-centered thought. So again, it says, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so when it says self here, it means the self-centeredness, not the conventionally existent self. And so, you know, we might wonder, well, how do we oppose this mind that just thinks about me, me, me all the time? You know, what do we do with it? Well, part of it is when we see the disadvantages, like when we study this text and it points out, you know, kind of all these embarrassing faults and flaws that we have, and when we fess up to ourselves and we see the disadvantages of these things, then just seeing the disadvantage itself gives us a tremendous amount of energy not to follow the self-centered thought. You know, because we start developing a mind that can see, oh, when I do this, it brings those kind of results. Whereas before, when we're under the influence of self-centeredness, we don't look at the long-term results. We just look at the short-term results, the short-term benefit we can get. We don't think long-term. You know, and this is one of the things that in working with the inmates that many of them say to me is, you know, as they're starting to change inside, they're beginning to see that their actions have long-term results. Whereas when they were young and their minds were just, you know, when they got involved in whatever criminal activities they were doing, they didn't have that thought that, you know, my actions bring long-term results. They were just looking at what was felt good at right at that very moment. And, you know, they wound up landing in prison. And here we're just talking this life, you know, not thinking that if I get involved with this, I might land in prison or I might harm somebody or, you know, like that. So they don't think even that far in advance. So they get involved in all sorts of negative things, and then this life wind up with suffering. But then even to think beyond this life, that, you know, even if I do this and, you know, chances are I won't get caught or whatever, but still it's an unethical thing that when I harm others, I'm harming myself because I'm putting negative imprints in my own mind, and this is going to have long-term, you know, consequences in my future lives, and it's going to cause interferences on my progress towards liberation and enlightenment. And so when we see those faults and the effects of it, it gives us the power to restrain ourselves, you know, because we don't want to, you know, get into those kinds of problems. So that's one antidote just to following the self-centeredness. Another one that I think works very, very well is to really imbue our mind with the thought that everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer just like I do, you know. And we all know that intellectually, but to really consider it and bring it into our hearts. And I was thinking about this, you know, on our walk today, you know, as we were making up these stories about these people, that these people just want to be happy and not suffer. You know, and that's the basic thing about everybody is they just want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. And if we approach people on that level of them, you know, them being just like us and being friendly in that way, chances are they'll respond that way. If they'll come, they'll answer our questions and go talk to us. But, you know, to really spend time thinking that, you know, everybody just wants to be happy and not suffer. And whether they agree with our political ideas, whether they're nice to us or whether they're mean to us, none of that matters because actually, you know, we're all the same in wanting to be happy and not suffer. And we may have different things that make us happy. We may have different things that we don't like and that make us suffer. But still, you know, we're all alike in that respect, and there's no way that we can really justify saying my happiness is more important than anybody else's. You know, even if it's just a little bug. Yeah, I mean, it's so tempting to just kind of, you know, mistreat a bug, but if we think, you know, this bug wants to be happy and not suffer just like me, then we, you know, restrain ourselves. One time, last week, when was it? I was writing, must have been when we were going to Coeur d'Alene, and I found a tick. And I should have asked the person driving to pull over to the side so I could put it down, but I didn't. You know, I just put it out the window. And immediately when I did that, I didn't feel very good about it, because I was thinking, boy, you know, this poor tick hitting this blast of air. You know, that wasn't very good of me to do that to him. I certainly wouldn't like that. So, anyway, so just, you know, working on, the more we see this with others, and the more we can develop, you know, genuine respect and care and affection for other living beings. Okay, then the next one says, though gods, and here it says gods, I think it means like the deities, the Buddhist deities. So though the deities bestow me happiness, I propitiate evil spirits. Though the Dharma guides me, I deceive the three jewels. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. So it's saying, you know, again, even though it says gods, I think it means the Buddhist deities and the three jewels in general. So even though they are our real refuge and all happiness comes from listening to Dharma teaching and enacting the Dharma teaching. In other words, keeping the good ethical discipline that the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha recommend to us, you know, and doing the meditations on love and compassion and doing the purification meditations. Even though that's, you know, how they guide us, how they bestow happiness on us. It isn't, you know, that they give us happiness here, you know, but they teach us the method for developing the cause of happiness in our own life. What do we do instead is we propitiate evil spirits and deceive the three jewels. Okay? So deceiving the three jewels could mean lying to our spiritual mentors, you know, or just lying to our own self in a harmful way. And then propitiating evil spirits. Now, remember, this text was written in India and then taught widely in Tibet. And, you know, it's cultures where they believe in a lot of spirits. Here, some people believe in spirits here, maybe not so much. But you may be aware that you know, there was in recent years some big difficulty within the Tibetan community, particularly within the Gelugpa tradition, because a number of people were doing a certain practice that His Holiness the Dalai Lama said is propitiating an evil spirit. And these people should instead stick with the traditional Buddhist practices. And it caused a big upheaval in the community. And His Holiness's concern was not that he had it out to get this evil spirit or, you know, wrench people away from this practice or cause division or anything like that, but because doing this practice caused division within the Tibetan community, because the spirit, you know, it's a whole complicated thing, but was causing division in the Tibetan community. That was one reason, but I think the principal reason why His Holiness recommended people give up the practice was that they were doing too much time propitiating this spirit and not enough time doing regular Dharma practice. And so he felt that, you know, doing all these protector pujas and these kinds of things was distracting people from the main point of the Dharma, which is to transform our own mind. Yeah. And so I think that's the real reason why he was recommending that people give that up. Because they were getting distracted from doing the principal thing that they had set out to as Dharma practitioners. Because real Dharma practice, and, you know, it's not about doing pujas and beating drums and ringing bells and praising, you know, a Dharma protector. Real Dharma practice is understanding the nature of our own mind. And, you know, if you want to do something with the Dharma protector, realizing that the Dharma protector is also empty of inherent existence. And realizing the nature of the Dharma protector, you know, this is an appearance and it's not inherently existent. You know, instead of thinking, oh, this is some kind of real external, you know, deity or God or spirit or whatever who's going to protect me. And so people were really kind of missing the boat. You know, in terms of a Western context, you know, the three jewels, you know, the Buddhist deities bestow happiness, and though the Dharma guides me, you know, what do we do to propitiate evil spirits? You know, we go to the bar, we go to the computer, and we have our computer intoxication of, you know, playing computer games. We sit down in front of the TV, yeah. We go shopping, so we have all of our own little pet hobbies, our own kinds of addictions and substance abuses that detract us from real Dharma practice. So I think the context of our society, you know, the evil spirit that we're getting distracted by is maybe trying to make a quick buck. Okay, trying to meet Prince Charming online. You know, all these sites that fix you up with somebody. Or, you know, going shopping and buying this, that, and the other thing. Or, you know, I mean, all the things that we do that just waste time and waste energy and detracts us from what we're really supposed to, you know, saying that we want to be doing and supposed to be doing. Okay, so again, the antidote is dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, so our self-centered thought, you know, and mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. So instead of just giving in to these negative habits and going along with them and having the short-term view that's only seeking my happiness now, you know, having a big-term view that is seeking the happiness of all living beings for all of infinity, you know, and the happiness we're wishing for all living beings, including ourselves, isn't just the happiness of having, you know, ice cream on a hot day. It's the happiness of enlightenment and of the happiness of having no fear of the afflictions because we've eliminated them from our mind. And the happiness of having spontaneous love and compassion for other living beings because that's what we've cultivated in our own hearts.